Chapter 9, The Pilgrim Ship. Our pilgrim ship, the Silk al-Zahab, or the Golden Wire, was a sambuk of about 50 tons, with narrow wedge-like bows, a clean waterline, a sharp keel, and undecked except upon the poop, which was high enough to act as a sail in a gale of wind. She carried two masts, raking imminently forwards, the main being considerably larger than the mizzen. The former was provided with a huge triangular lateen, very deep in the tack, but the second sail was unaccountably wanting. She had no means of reefing, no compass, no log, no sounding lines, no spare ropes, nor even the suspicion of a chart. In her box-like cabin and ribbed hold, there was something which savoured of close connection between her model and that of the Indian Tony, or dugout. The first look at the interior of our vessel showed a hopeless sight. Ali Murad, the greedy owner, had promised to take 60 passengers in the hold, but had stretched the number to 97. Piles of boxes and luggage in every shape and form filled the ship from stem to stern, and a torrent of hajis were pouring over the sides like ants into the East Indian sugar basin. The poop, too, where we had taken our places, was covered with goods, and a number of pilgrims had established themselves there by might, not by right. Presently, to our satisfaction, appeared Saad the Demon, equipped as an able seaman, and looking most unlike the proprietor of two large boxes full of valuable merchandise. This energetic individual instantly prepared for action. With our little party to back him, he speedily cleared the poop of intruders and their stuff by the simple process of pushing, or rather throwing them off it, into the pit below. We then settled down as comfortably as we could. Three Syrians, a married Turk with his wife and family, the Rais, or captain, of the vessel, with a portion of his crew, and our seven selves, composing a total of 18 human beings, upon a space certainly not exceeding 10 feet by 8. The cabin, a miserable box about the size of the poop and 3 feet high, was stuffed like the hold of a slave ship with 15 wretches, children and women, and the other 97 were disposed upon the luggage or squatted on the bulwarks. Having some experience in such matters, and being favoured by fortune, I found a spare bed-frame slung to the ship's side, and giving a dollar to its owner, a sailor, who flattered himself that because it was his he would sleep upon it, I instantly appropriated it, preferring any hardship outside to the condition of a packed heading inside, the place of torment. The first thing to be done after gaining standing room was to fight for greater comfort, and never a hollyhead packet in the olden time showed a finer scene of pugnacity than did our pilgrim ship. A few Turks, ragged old men from Anatolia and Caramania, were mixed up with the Maghrebis, and the former began the war by contemptuously elbowing and scolding their wild neighbours. The Maghrebis, under their leader Maula Ali, a burly savage, in whom I detected a ridiculous resemblance to the Reverend Charles Delafosse, an old and well-remembered schoolmaster, retorted so willingly that in a few minutes nothing was to be seen but a confused mass of humanity, each item indiscriminately punching and pulling, scratching and biting, butting and trampling with cries of rage, and all the accompaniments of a proper fray, whatever was obnoxious to such operations. One of our party on the poop, a Syrian, somewhat incautiously leapt down to aid his countrymen by restoring order. He sank immediately below the surface of the living mass, and when we fished him out, his forehead was cut open, half his beard had disappeared, and a fine sharp set of teeth belonging to some Maghrebi had left their mark in the calf of his leg. The enemy showed no love of fair play, and never appeared contented unless five or six of them were setting upon a single man. This made matters worse. The weaker, of course, drew their daggers, and a few bad wounds were soon given and received. In a few minutes, five men were completely disabled, and the victors began to dread the consequences of their victory. Then the fighting stopped, and, as many couldn't find places, it was agreed that a deputation should wait upon Ali Murad, the owner, to inform him of the crowded state of the vessel. After keeping us in expectation at least 3 hours, he appeared in a rowboat, preserving a respectful distance, and informed us that anyone who pleased might quit the ship and take back his fare. This left the case exactly as it was before. None would abandon his party to go on shore, so Ali Murad rowed off towards Suez, giving us a parting injunction to be good and not fight, to trust in Allah, and that Allah would make all things easier to us. His departure was the signal for a second fray, which in its accidents differed a little from the first. During the previous disturbance, we kept our places with weapons in our hands. This time we were summoned by the Maghrebis to relieve their difficulties by taking about half a dozen of them on the poop. Saad the demon at once rose with an oath and threw amongst us a bundle of Nabut, goodly ashen staves, 6 feet long, thick as a man's wrist, well greased and tried in many a rough bout. He shouted to us, "Defend yourselves if you don't wish to be the meat of the Maghrebis," and to the enemy, "Dogs and sons of dogs, now shall you see what the children of the Arab are. I am Omar of Dagestan. I am Abdullah the son of Joseph. I am Saad the demon," we exclaimed, renowning it by this display of name and patronymic. To do our enemies justice, they showed no sign of flinching. They swarmed towards the poop like angry hornets, and encouraged each other with cries of "Allahu Akbar!" But we had a vantage ground about 4 feet above them, and their palm sticks and short daggers could do nothing against our terrible quarter-staves. In vain the Jacquerie tried to scale the poop and to overpower us by numbers. Their courage only secured them more broken heads. At first I began to lay on load with ma mort, really fearing to kill someone with such a weapon. But it soon became evident that the Maghrebis' heads and shoulders could bear and did require the utmost exertion of strength. Presently a thought struck me. A large earthen jar full of drinking water, in its heavy frame of wood, the weight might have been 100 pounds, stood upon the edge of the poop, and the thick of the fray took place beneath. Seeing an opportunity, I crept up to the jar, and without attracting attention, rolled it down by a smart push with the shoulder upon the swarm of assailants. The fall caused a shriller shriek to rise above the ordinary din, for heads, limbs, and bodies were sorely bruised by the weight, scratched by the broken potsherds, and wetted by the sudden discharge. A fear that something worse might be coming made the Maghrebis slink off towards the end of the vessel. After a few minutes we, sitting in grave silence, received a deputation of individuals in whitey-brown burnous, spotted and striped with what Mephistopheles called a curious juice. They solicited peace, which we granted, upon the condition that they would pledge themselves to keep it. Our heads, shoulders, and hands were penitentially kissed, and presently the fellows returned to bind up their hurts in dirty rags. At length, about 3 p.m. on the 6th of July, 1853, we shook out the sail, and as it bellied in the favourable wind, we recited the Fatiha with upraised hands, which we afterwards drew down our faces. As the Golden Wire started from her place, I couldn't help casting one wistful look upon the British flag floating over the consulate. But the momentary regret was stifled by the heart-pounding which prospects of an adventure excite, and by the real pleasure of leaving Egypt. I'd lived there a stranger in the land, and a hapless life it had been. In the streets, every man's face, as he looked upon the Persian, was the face of a foe. Whenever I came in contact with the native officials, insolence marked the event. And the circumstance of living within hail of my fellow countrymen, and yet finding it impossible to enjoy their society, still throws a gloom over the memory of my first sojourn in Egypt. The ships of the Red Sea, infamous region of rocks, reefs, and shoals, cruise along the coast by day, and at night lay to in the first cove they find. They do not sail when it blows hard, and as in winter time the weather's often stormy and the light of day doesn't last long, the voyage is intolerably slow. At sunset we stayed our adventurous course, and still within sight of Suez, comfortably anchored under the lee of Jabal Ataka, the Mountain of Deliverance, the butt end of Jabal Joshi. We were now on classic waters. The eastern shore was dotted with the little grove of palm trees which clusters around the Uyun Musa, or Moses Wells, and on the west, between two towering ridges, lay the mouth of the valley down which, according to Father Sicard, the Israelites fled to the Sea of Sedge, the Hebrew name of this part of the Red Sea. Next morning, the 7th of July, before the cerulean hue had vanished from the hills, we set sail. It wasn't long before we came to a proper sense of our position. The box containing my store of provisions, and worse still, my opium, was at the bottom of the hold, perfectly unapproachable. We had, therefore, the pleasure of breaking our fast on mare's skin, which is a composition of apricot paste, dried, spread out, and folded into sheets, exactly resembling the article after which it is named, and a species of biscuit, hard as a stone and quite as tasteless. During the day, whilst insufferable splendour reigned above, the dashing of the waters below kept my nest in a state of perpetual drench. At night rose a cold, bright moon, with dews falling so thick and clammy that the skin felt as though it would never be dry again. It is also by no means pleasant to sleep upon a broken cot about 4 feet long by 2 broad, with the certainty that a false movement would throw you overboard, and a conviction that if you do fall from a sambuk under sail, no mortal power can save you. And as under all circumstances in the East, dozing is one's chief occupation, the reader will understand that the want of it left me in utter idleness.